You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, conversations with the icons of our time.
The whole time I was incarcerated, waiting to be sentenced, I was planning to get back in the marijuana business. When he said, "Have you ever heard of cocaine?" You know, I said, "Well, tell me about it."
Drug lord George Jung. Today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Bill Thompson. It's not every day that I would sit across the table from one of the world's most notorious drug kingpins. But one summer day in 1993, I did just that. Sitting in my studio that day was a man named George Jung, who was there to discuss a book that had just been written and published about him by journalist Bruce Porter called Blow. Porter's book was also the basis for that 2001 movie starring Johnny Depp as George Jung, the movie called Blow. So how did a kid from a small town in Massachusetts become one of the world's most notorious drug lords? Well, George Jung's answer is at once simple and terrifying. So here now, from 1993, George Jung and author Bruce Porter.
I had covered drugs a lot when I was a writer at Newsweek, and for newspapers I'd cover the hippies of the 60s, LSD, Timothy Leary, and I noticed that the people involved in the distribution of drugs were basically middle class people who came from normal homes on your block. And And when I'd heard of the Later trial, when Carlos Later was sent away in 1988, the main person who testified against him and was responsible for his getting life plus 135 years was George Jung, who came from a small town in New England, Weymouth, Massachusetts, and was indeed a local high school football star and an all-American boy in his youth. And I was intrigued with how he came close to the top of the Medellin cartel.
And what must have struck you, as it will strike any reader who reads this, is, I mean, you didn't grow up as a kid grabbing old ladies' purses and stealing cars and shooting firecrackers in the principal's office. You were a normal kid.
That's correct. Until the 60s came along.
Those none of those classic early indicators that every parent is taught to watch out for to see if the kid's going to turn to a life of crime. You were a regular kid.
I was somewhat of a regular kid. My sister wouldn't agree with that. I had read several books by Kerouac and Hemingway and Jack London, and the adventurous spirit as I grew older was growing up within me also.
But at what point along the way does an adventurous spirit become a life of crime?
Well, I attended several colleges and then migrated out to California. And it was a drastic change from Weymouth, Massachusetts to Southern California in the 60s. And I started smoking marijuana out there and surfing and the girls were magnificent in the bathing suits compared to the girls' bathing suits in Massachusetts, highly conservative, and it was wide open. It was like going to Disney World. And as I smoked more and more marijuana and took more LSD, I started dealing drugs in small amounts to supply my needs. And as some boyhood friends that were attending universities in Massachusetts came out for the summer to visit, and they noticed a big bowl of marijuana at my beach house, and they said, "How much did you pay for that?" And I said, approximately $60 to $80. And they said, "We can sell this for $300 back there in Massachusetts." And our eyes lit up, because at that time, if even a college graduate was getting out of school and making, $8,000 to $12,000 a year? And then we started in the business of transporting marijuana from California to Northeast, and We were making thousands of dollars and having a good time at it.
But clearly this is not a book about a businessman, is it?
Well, it's a book about an adventurer, a businessman, and an outlaw.
Do you have to set any kind of moral, ethical, legal things in your mind aside to write a book like this? Or can you just tell a story and let readers judge? Or do you, what is your role in telling the story?
I think you have to set everything aside. I think you tell a story. You tell a story in a certain way so a feeling comes through about why George Jung ended up the way he did. I think there is a difference between making something understandable and making it excusable. And what I aim, I mean, I've done magazine articles about people who did much more horrible things than George did. I didn't excuse any of it, but to make it understandable, I think, is an accomplishment to aim at.
When you were sent to the federal prison in Danbury, this was severe punishment for you, wasn't it?
No, it really wasn't, because it was in essence a crime school, and it was majority of the people had some college or college degrees, and there were doctors, lawyers, and people and ex-smugglers, and they were planning to smuggle again, and it was virtual vault of information and new contacts.
The one line that is very chilling when apparently Carlos comes up to you and he says, "So, have you ever heard of cocaine?" And since you know how the rest of the book comes out and what happens, it's a chilling line. Did you realize that at the moment?
The whole time I was incarcerated, waiting to be sentenced, which was approximately 6 months, I guess, in Chicago, I was planning already then, at that time, to go back to Mexico when I got out and get back in the marijuana business. So it didn't faze me to any degree. And when he said, "Have you ever heard of cocaine?" You know, I said, "Well, tell me about it."
I think what really interested George, well, and what's fairly astounding, is the difference in the economics between being a pot transporter and a cocaine transporter. I mean, the best deal he did with pot was to go down to Mexico and get it for $25 a kilo to fly it into the dry lake beds and to put it in a Winnebago, drive the Winnebago east to Amherst. There was a lot of work, and he ended up selling it for $300. So it was roughly a tenfold increase. In the cocaine business, he could sell that same kilo for it was for $60,000 that he would have gotten down in Colombia at the time for about $3,000 or $4,000. So it was twice the markup, and the money was just huge in the cocaine business. So it was very attractive to him almost immediately.
After this short break, George Jung explains how piles and piles of money became less and less important.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 1993 interview with George Jung and Bruce Porter.
It's almost ridiculous at this point to ask, didn't you think about maybe getting a regular job, like being a shoe salesman or selling insurance or something?
Well, as Bob Dylan said, 20 years of school and they put you on the day shift.
But, I mean, let's put it this way. Who would say no to it if you set aside the moral and the legal questions? At some point, you know it's from the very beginning it's illegal to do. But you do it anyway.
For the money and the power and the adventure. Actually, after a certain point, the money becomes not that important it any longer. It's the adventure that you become addicted to, that high.
I talk to gambling addicts who say the same thing. The money isn't what they gamble for. It's the thrill of gambling, the thrill of playing your skill against somebody else's.
It's a game. It's the ultimate game. You're risking your life, and it's a super high.
I couldn't help thinking, you know, when we talk about $100 million you made, $100 million tax-free, we might also point out. Now when we're talking about the Powerball lottery, and this guy in Wisconsin's got $110 million, and the government's going to get their share first, but everybody's wondering what they would do with $110 million. So a question, what did you do with $100 million?
You do whatever you want to do, anytime you want to do it.
It's the old story of the gorilla, right? He does what he wants to do. And go ahead, George.
Well, in essence, a lot of it was stolen from me, but I spent a huge amounts, too, traveling and buying expensive toys. And there's a lot of women out there that should send me back some of it.
And also, in reading this, it just makes it sound so ludicrous and so silly to just say no.
No, but you've got to teach people not to take drugs. Drugs don't take you. People take drugs.
But how do you do
that? Nobody forces it on them. I believe how you do it is you educate people at the grade school level and teach them from there on up not to take drugs. I mean, you're going to lose a few, but I think you will win more than you'll lose. And what's wrong with trying it? Because it's the hundreds and hundreds and millions of dollars that we're spending now and the manpower and filling the prisons up with people, it's just not working. And it's impossible to stop the importation of drugs. It's been going on since day one, way before I came along in the cartel. I mean, the opium trade built huge homes in New England for sea captains, and it's just been going on forever. And if you want to stop, suppose Colombia shut down tomorrow, who's going to shut down China from sending heroin into the United States? Or who's going to shut down the cash crops within the United States, the marijuana crops? Or the chemists who make drugs, manufacturing them right in their own country? It's just not going to happen unless people just stop taking them of their own volition. But they have to be taught not to take. I mean, you can teach people to do calculus, math, all kinds of mathematics, teach them to talk and walk, but you can't teach them not to, about drugs? Why isn't it a concentrated effort being made in this country to do that? And why does a janitor in New York City make twice what a teacher makes?
I think there are probably a lot of different kinds of theories to explain why America, in particular, has a huge drug problem. But one thing I think we know, and I think which the book exposes quite dramatically, is the cops don't work as our main defense against drugs. I mean, one thing is obvious that all through George's life and the life of and the history of cocaine importation is the irrelevance of the police. I mean, when the war on drugs began in 1982, which was involved on a huge expenditure of money, and some 80 tons of cocaine was coming into the country in 1982. And the price of the average gram on the street was $100 for a gram of cocaine. Last month, when they uncovered that huge hole in San Diego that the drug smugglers had started to build a huge tunnel, the government announced that over 400 tons was being imported each year, and the price of a street gram was down to $35. So there was five times as much stuff coming in. It was cheaper than ever before, despite the billions and billions of dollars and the hundreds of thousands of arrests and the hundreds of tons seized. It still made no dent. So clearly, the cops don't work. Something else has got to be examined.
But we also haven't been able to get people to stop smoking.
Look at that.
So it's
well, I smoke, and nicotine is more addictive than cocaine, and I've done both, so.
What do you say to people who ask you if you've gone straight?
I have gone straight. My days of crime and adventure are over, and I like to open the door and be able to walk out of it whenever I want, regardless of if I'm low on funds or whatever. I still can go out that door when I want. I spent approximately 7.5 years of my adult life in jails and looking over my shoulder. In fact, spent most of the time driving an automobile looking in the rearview mirror to see who was following me more than out the windshield.
Are you just darn lucky to still be alive?
I'd say it was luck.
Less than a year after this interview, George Jung was arrested again after being caught with 1,700 pounds of cocaine. He was sentenced to prison and did almost 20 years before his release in 2014. George Jung died in 2021 at age 78. Now you can get a copy of Blow by Bruce Porter and George Jung by tapping the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. Heardeverything.com is where you can also hear my 1998 interview with former Hollywood stuntwoman and mob getaway car driver Georgia Durante.
I really didn't know that this is what I was doing, but I was a wheel woman for the mob. They were in these places, robbing these places, and I was driving the getaway car. But I had no idea that's what they were doing.
And my 1986 interview with the woman who was busted in the 1980s for running a high-end prostitution ring. She was dubbed the Mayflower Madam, Sydney Biddle Barrows.
I don't want to let everybody think that all escort services are run like this. One of the things that I tried to do was to make it fun and to make it glamorous and to give the girls an opportunity to have a good time.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, back in the 1970s, millions of women had two books on their bookshelf, The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, and The Female Eunuch by Germaine Greer. So we'll revisit my 1987 interview with Germaine Greer.
People took the female eunuch to be telling them to go out and be sexually active. The female eunuch was bought a lot. I don't know that it was read a lot. I think it was a book you had to have on the bookshelf. You didn't have to actually know what it said.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.